Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben, and it's been about 3 years, I think, since we've done a solo podcast episode. I'll be honest, I don't remember how to do them. I have no idea how I got up here and spoke by myself uninterrupted for like 40 minutes, 60 minutes. Did we have hour-long episodes? I don't know how to do it. We'll see if we can do it today. This might be the only solo podcast we ever do again. I'm just used to having Cody here for banter. I need banter. I mean, the man once did an entire segment on bison gravy, venison gravy, and potatoes. I mean, you can't replace that when you're by yourself. So it's gonna be an adventure today. But I don't want to do. Someone said we've come a long way from when I just used to sit up here on the podcast and read numbers for half an hour. And so my goal today is not to read numbers, but also I wanted to reboot the solo podcast because this very much is a sort of specific dry idea that won't appeal to everyone or isn't something that we would think about every day. But my goal is to at least make it fun and interesting and work through it quickly, conceptually, without like getting bogged down into too many numbers. And, I still don't know how to do a show without having fun back and forth on with little sidebars and things like that. I'm very spoiled by that. So we'll see what kind of tangents. Maybe I can interrupt myself today. Years ago, when I first started this show, I had a mic and I was on the floor of my living room. I lived in a very small apartment at the time. And I put the mic on the coffee table and I just recorded the first couple episodes just talking to myself about these basketball things that I had been researching at that point in time in the living room. It felt super weird, but I remember thinking like, maybe I should create an alter ego that I can argue with myself and create some kind of like lighthearted effect. Never got around to it. How could you replicate an alter ego like Cody, a legendary Bucks fan? He's missed around here, but certainly we take what we can get from him these days. So here's the topic. Here's the idea for today's show for the 13 of you that are going to be interested in this. We did an episode a couple years ago on rebounding and how rebounding has changed and how, to me, it's lost a lot of its value just because the difference between a good rebounder and a poor rebounder isn't necessarily the same as it was in the 80s and 90s. There aren't as many guys in the paint jostling for position. And of course, we know this because we're in the pace and space era. So now we get to something like turnovers, which is the other big thing that's been in my head like for years. Like, what is the deal with turnovers? Are they important? Are they not important? How valuable are they? I think if you talk to any coaches especially, they will tell you something like, we got to take care of the ball. Turnovers are key. If you think about it from a defensive perspective, I mean, the best outcome you could have in basketball is probably forcing a turnover. Like, the other team didn't even get a shot. I think it's a pretty good deal if the other team didn't even get a shot. So turnovers, at least on the surface, feel like a really big thing, but they're never talked about. Outside of these games where, you know, someone has 10 turnovers or 12 turnovers, Magic Johnson, 1980, game 5 of the NBA Finals, at the time, I don't know if it's been matched or broken, at the time set the record for turnovers in a finals game, maybe a playoff game back then, because they only started tracking turnovers in 1974. He had 10 turnovers in that game. The reason why that's so memorable is Magic came back in game 6 after Kareem Abdul-Jabbar sprained his ankle. He famously jumped center and he played just one of the greatest games you'll ever see as a rookie. I think it actually inflates our perception as a community of how good he was as a rookie, because like, that might have been the best game Magic Johnson played between 1980 and 1984, 1985, period. Just that game was a masterpiece, 42 points, 15 rebounds, 6 or 7 assists. He was just incredible without Kareem. But I remember the game before because of all the turnovers. And sometimes when you have turnovers like that, it stands out. This team committed 23 turnovers in a game seven. They fell apart. So it comes up occasionally. But like, where's the value? What does it mean to be a low turnover player or a high turnover player? This has come up with Steve Nash. We'll talk about him today. And then our ultimate direction is baking in turnovers and trying to add a little bit more meaning to some of the other numbers that we typically talk about. I'll take us full circle to a stat I've been using for a while that I developed this year called overall scoring percentage that tries to bake in turnovers into a number that's maybe a little bit more holistic than what we get with effective field goal and true shooting percentage and things like that. And when you do that, how does that impact sort of the way we view all-time scores statistically? How does that impact someone like Nikola Jokic, how we view him? Because that's when I started this. I started with Zion Williamson a couple years ago. That was a video in maybe 2021 where Zion was getting to the rim a ton, grabbing misses, following his putbacks, and I like noticed, like, okay, what if we accounted for the fact that he's just getting his own miss and putting it back in? How does that change his scoring? From there, you fold in turnovers. So that's where we're ultimately headed. But first, let's tackle the turnover question. Let's think about what this means for different kinds of players, point guards, scorers like Michael Jordan and Kawhi Leonard and things like that. And as a reminder, if you're new to these parts and you're still listening to me ramble after 6 or 7 minutes, we can't perfectly ever like separate stuff in basketball. I think that's something that makes analyzing basketball so interesting. There's a ton of data to analyze, but at the same time, we can never really pinpoint like this is just scoring. This is just passing or playmaking because they obviously influence each other. We've talked a ton about this over the years. So when we think about something like turnovers, one question that immediately comes to my mind is there a trade-off between like shooting it at the basket, getting a shot off, and being a little more, say, passive with your scoring moves, you know, settling, quote unquote, settling for mid-range jumpers, taking post fadeaways, things like that, versus trying to create a higher leverage shot, a higher value shot, driving into the teeth of the defense, and sometimes turning it over a little bit more. Because in theory, again, the turnover is like the worst possible play for the offense. And there's different kinds of turnovers, right? There are turnovers that are forced. There are turnovers that are unforced. There are turnovers early in the clock. That's a big deal because you have the whole possession to generate higher value looks. If you look at an NBA possession, if you were to graph it on a screen, and if you're watching with me solo on YouTube, hey, I appreciate it. Where's Cody? Why am I so big in this picture? It doesn't make any sense. But if you were to graph it on a screen, you would see something like early in the clock has the highest return on the possession. I don't know what it is these days off the top of my head. It might be 1.1 points per possession, 1.2 points per possession when you're early in the clock. That's a little a chicken egg thing because it's a reflection of getting good looks early in the possession. But as the clock dwindles, what happens is your value goes down. So it goes down like to a point, to 0.9 points, to 0.8 points as you have fewer and fewer seconds on the clock. By the time you get to like 5 or 6 seconds, if defensively you have stalled all the actions and the ball swings back to the top of the key, or similarly, you can check this in the actual data. If there's an out of bounds with 5, 6, 7 seconds left on the clock, the value, the expected value of that possession is very low at that point. So turnovers early in the possession theoretically are much worse than turnovers later in the possession. And these may be things in the future that people can go in and try to parse out if we're really splitting hairs and saying like, who's committing good versus bad turnovers and what does this all mean? But this is like the world of turnovers, trying to figure out what this means and then make sense of it. as I said, we don't really hear about turnovers unless we're talking about like Michael Jordan getting stripped by Nick Anderson at the end of the game in 1995 when Jordan comes back and the Magic upset the Bulls. Otherwise, turnovers are usually kind of out of sight, out of mind. Every year, people ask me about working in basketball professionally or even how we add people to the Thinking Basketball team, and Sports Business Classroom is one of my go-to answers, and let me tell you why. It's professional, hands-on teaching from industry leaders and experts that sets you up to work in basketball. Alumni have gone on to work for multiple NBA teams, major media outlets like The Athletic, Clutch Sports, and more. This year's new lead instructor is ESPN's Bobby Marks, and the curriculum covers scouting, analytics, media, and the salary cap. The program is a six-day immersive experience that takes place July 14th to 20th in Las Vegas during Summer League. And for a limited time, use the code THINKINGBASKETBALL for $600 off early bird registration. Interest is at an all-time high right now, and there are only 125 spots in the program, so you currently use Thinking Basketball at sign-up for $600 off that early bird price if you're interested at sportsbusinessclassroom.com. But let's stick with this idea of when are they important, how valuable are they? One game that I watched recently was Kobe Bryant's 2006 50-point game against the Suns in Game 6. That's a series. The Suns ended up winning in 7. That Game 6 was a classic. It went to overtime. I want to say Kobe had a bunch of points at the end of overtime when they had a lead, when the Suns kind of pulled away at the end. Either way, he ends up with a game that is his classic game, classic 50-point playoff game. I think that's his career high in a playoff game. I know he had 48 and 49 in some other runs in big games. But he also had 7 turnovers in that game and 5 turnovers in the first half alone. And it's like, what does that mean? When we watch the single Michael Jordan play getting stripped by Nick Anderson, we know it's a disaster. We know fumbling the ball and then creating a live ball situation where the opponent is expected to score at a really high rate is really bad. You never got a shot off. It's worse than getting a shot off. When you get a shot off, you can at least rebound it. Live ball turnovers and steals like that are like the worst thing an offense can do. So we know that. We know that's really, really bad. But is it different than missing jumpers? Like, what's an actual thing we can look at? So I was watching this game, and he has a couple turnovers early in the first quarter, first half, that are just vanilla. You know, like he fumbles the ball late in the clock in traffic. He commits an offensive foul. He throws a bad pass, stuff like that. He had a traveling violation in the middle of the second quarter that if you're rewatching this game, you're like, I don't think they're calling that today, ever. He's in the post. He spins. It doesn't look like too much is going on with the pivot feet. I don't think that's getting called almost every time today. Anyway, here's what I wanted to focus on. You get to the end of the half, and they run this play late in the clock with him. Pick and roll. He asks for the rescreen. Sorry, it's not late in the clock yet. It's early in the possession. Pick and roll. He asks for a rescreen. He gets around sort of the first line of defense, gets into the paint, gets stuck in the paint. Then as the clock is dwindling, this whole thing, because he asked for a rescreen, brings the clock, the shot clock and the possession clock down. He's in the paint. He's picked up his dribble. Kwame Brown is open in the corner, and he could kick it to Kwame Brown. And today you might see the video we did on this where you pass and chase after the ball and reset that way. But it almost feels like there's this moment he doesn't trust Kwame Brown. He's double-teamed. He decides to shoot as the clock is running down. I don't remember, 6 seconds, 5 seconds, something like that on the shot clock. Then realizes he's in the air, gets stuck in the air, and kicks it out at the last second instead of shooting. And that's the interesting thing to me when we think about folding in turnovers with shooting percentages. Because when we look at players and we judge them as scorers, when we judge them as players, when we line up all-star teams and we say, this guy averaged 23 and 7, this guy averaged 26 and 8, Of course, at the most basic level, you can look at like just raw field goal percentage or something not very informative like that. But for years, we've talked about true shooting percentage as taking into account all of the shots. And it's like in that moment when Kobe's hanging in the air and he decides not to shoot and he kicks it to the perimeter, what he's done is he's avoided missing a shot. He's avoided that because he didn't think he could make the shot or it was going to get blocked. And he's traded it off for a turnover on the pass. And what happens is he kicks it out to the perimeter. No one's open because he changed his mind at the last second. Suns pick up the ball, run the other way, and they get free throws. He actually, on that particular play, he made an extraordinary chase down block that was totally clean up top. I don't think it should have been a foul. He got the call on the foul hitting Leandro Barbosa down low with his body. So he makes the pass and sprints down the court and basically erases his mistake. But in that case, anytime you get a run out like that, very, very, very high expected value for the team going the other way. They get free throws. They get 2 points. Well, shortly after that, they come back down the court again. They take a 20-second timeout. Phil Jackson wants to diagram a play. It's 14 seconds left in the play. How are we doing, by the way? I feel like this is the moment in the show where Cody comes in and he's got stories left and right, and we're bouncing questions off each other and we're getting on philosophical sidebars. And here I am just rambling 18-year-old play-by-play from classic playoff games. So where was I? They call timeout. Phil Jackson sets up this play for Kobe. Maybe like a little screen from Roni Turioff or something. Roni slips down the middle of the lane. Kobe actually misses him on the pass so he can isolate and drive. Ends up taking it off the dribble, drives into the teeth of the defense, and gets an offensive foul. Gets a charge. Tries to score and gets a charge. So that's not a live ball turnover like the one before, but there's no rebounding chance. And in this case, it leaves a couple seconds on the clock because normally you'd have the flight of the ball up in the air, the rebound comes off. Anyway, there's like 5 or 6 seconds still left on the clock. The Lakers obviously wanted to run it down to like 1 or 2 seconds. And then on the inbounds, Barbosa actually backdoors Kobe in the backcourt, sprints into the front court, catches a pass, and scores on a layup, or gets a little runner in the lane off of that. So these are situations where if you look in the box score after the game and you're like, you know, Kobe was 20 of 35, we're so used to intuiting he missed 15 opportunities to score with his shot. But the reality is these turnovers are part of that process. When we get more refined data, we go to something like Second Spectrum, you'll hear people cite that, or Synergy Data. When you go to Synergy Data and you say, how does this guy perform in pick and roll settings? How does he perform as a post-up player? That's going to include turnovers. We want to include turnovers. We want to include passes and look at the whole picture. That's the holy grail. That's what we really care about. But in this case, we're going to focus on just turnovers on the scoring side, but we can get to turnovers on the passing side. And I actually think that's where I've gone personally in the last year or so, trying to make sense of why turnovers are important or how to use them. I still don't think statistically, just the raw numbers we have for turnovers are easy to parse. It's almost like field goal percentage. It's not super helpful. You need to know three-point percentage and the number of threes, and you need to know free throw attempts and the number of free throws, or else how are you going to figure out how efficient some guy is? You can't. Field goal percentage is a confounder. I said I wasn't going to get up and get all lectury here, and here I am getting into the weeds of field goal percentage and free throw percentage. Anyway, here's the takeaway. Here's where I've gone with turnovers. Here's what they mean to me today. I've been looking at, in the play-by-play since 2001, ball handling specific turnovers. Turnovers where you're dispossessed, basically, to borrow a soccer term. you are dispossessed of the basketball. It's no longer yours. It's been taken from you. Sometimes, technically, I guess you don't have to be dribbling. You can be holding your ball and someone can sneak up from behind you and poke it away. But I essentially categorize these as ball handling turnovers because they're turnovers where you have it, you're holding it, you're dribbling, and it's taken away. You fumble it away. There's passing turnovers in the play-by-play. Turnovers, all your passes that are intercepted or go out of bounds or things like that, they are tagged as bad passing turnovers. And again, drawing the line between like what scoring or something like that, I don't know the perfect way to do that. We just illustrated a play where Kobe Bryant committed a passing turnover, but he was going to score. It was really a scoring turnover. So sometimes the lines can get blurred. The concepts can get muddied a little bit. But there's also more turnovers in the play-by-play that are about charges, offensive fouls, things like that. So I look at passing turnovers and non-passing turnovers. The non-passing turnovers are really de facto scoring turnovers. They're connected to the scoring attempts that we're interested in that we're going to get to in a second. And then within the non-passing turnovers, I'm also very interested in the ball handling turnovers. And so I think that's a more meaningful way to try to understand how someone's committing turnovers, the rate they're committing turnovers. And it's one of those stats that, like so many basketball stats, you cannot use it in a vacuum. You can't be like, let me just look at this player's turnovers and have no concept of how much they're passing, how much they have the ball, how much they're trying to score, what their role is, things like that. Do they have a lot of assisted versus unassisted offense? These are things we can check going back at least 25 years. This data today is going to basically be from the 21st century. But we, you know, have like unassisted or assisted field goals going back into the 90s, into the late 90s. Okay. So let's talk about like Steve Nash versus Chris Paul. Steve Nash and Chris Paul are often the case study for low turnovers and high turnovers. And this is where I think we've been doing turnovers wrong. We've been doing it wrong. There's no other way to say it. Maybe I should have started the episode there. Should I have started the episode with that? Who does an episode about turnovers? This is the thing. I've been talking about turnovers for like 15 minutes. And my takeaway is that the turnovers actually aren't super important. There's just subtle information that I think moves the needle or changes our perspective or gives us little insights. And that's what they're good for. But you can't use just the single turnover number. And here's why. If you go and you look at Steve Nash, let's take 2007. That's the year I honed in on. If you use Basketball References turnovers, Nash is a guy that commits like whatever it is, 4 turnovers a game or something, a high amount of turnovers, high number of turnovers per 100. And if you look at Basketball References turnover percentage, which, not a fan. I'll tell you why in a second. Or maybe you'll see why in a second. If you look at that, Nash looks like one of the highest turnover percentage players in basketball. That year, 201 players qualified for the minute leaderboard. Nash had a turnover percentage of 21% using Basketball References method, which is basically like their usage rate and the percentage of turnovers from their usage rate. Anyway, that ranked 197th out of 201 players. 197th out of 201 players. That means that there were only 4 dudes in the NBA in 2007 who, quote-unquote, turned it over more than Steve Nash. And the big reason for this is that stat has no concept of playmaking. It has no concept of primacy outside of scoring. So it just thinks like, wow, relative to how much Steve Nash shoots, he turns the ball over a ton. And again, if you look at raw turnovers, or if you look at turnover percentage, you will come away with the impression that historically and within that season, Steve Nash is this incredibly high turnover player. He's risky, right? He lives on the edge. He can be reckless. There's got to be a trade-off with his turnovers. I've talked about this before. Chris Paul, on the other hand, is low turnover. Low turnover for most players, low turnover for point guards. He's got a great assist to turnover ratio. He's the beacon of conservatism. And that turnover economy maybe that's super valuable. Maybe Tyrese Halliburton's turnover economy is super valuable. We'll talk about that in a second. So, Nash's high turnover, looking at these numbers, Nash looks like one of the most turnover-prone players in the league. But, if we actually do a couple things. First, we account for playmaking. And if you go to thinkingbasketball.net, this is for Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball, the way we calculate usage on Basketball Reference is just like shooting and turnovers. We have a playmaking component. We're trying to estimate how much you're directly involved in offensive possessions. We call this offensive load. Turnovers are calculated based on your offensive load. So all of a sudden, when you include this playmaking component, Nash does not look like one of the highest turnover players in the league. Furthermore, when you break it out into the areas that I just discussed, if you only look at players with above average offensive load, Steve Nash in 2007 all of a sudden is near the top of the league in turnover economy. He was 12th in the league in those non-passing turnovers that I mentioned by percentage. That's like fumbles, travels, offensive fouls, things like that. He was 8th in the league among all players with above average offensive loads, regardless of the type of the style of play they played, regardless of how much they had the ball. 8th in the league in ball handling turnover percentage. And he was 7th in the league in his ratio of good passes, let's say good attacking passes to bad passes. That's another stat we can calculate by looking at the bad pass turnovers. We also have an estimate that we use in our passing and playmaking data that you could think of as attacking passes or sort of important good passes or things like that. So just call it like good to bad pass ratio. That's the way I've been thinking about it since I started using it. He's top 10 in that. So all of a sudden, when you make those adjustments and you start to account for how often the guy has the ball, what he's doing with the ball, and the types of turnovers he has, he looks like one of the least turnover-prone players in the league in basically all the categories that I'm personally interested in. That's the shift.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
That's a pretty big deal, right? To go from, like, the most turnover-prone player to the least, just because we left out the little part of playmaking or role or how often someone has the ball. And in fact, when you compare him to Chris Paul has a very similar non-passing turnover percentage from 2010 to 2020. Like that entire decade is actually a pretty similar number to Steve Nash's 2007. Paul still looks like a slightly lower turnover percentage player, even by these stats when you kind of zoom out. But just for perspective, like 2007 Nash, that's you're not going to be able to pick that out and differentiate from any Chris Paul season in the 2010s. And that's not even accounting for the fact that in the 2010s, those non-passing turnovers went down league-wide. That's another interesting thing you can do. You can look at the trends across time in the league, and you can see stuff like, well, ball handling turnovers have actually remained pretty consistent over the last 25 years that we have this data. Okay? The non-scoring turnovers the league has gotten a little better with. And the big turnover change league-wide is in the passing turnovers. And the ratio of good passes to bad passes has popped. It's nearly doubled, which is crazy to me. It's nearly doubled. It used to be closer to like 2-1, under 2-1, one and a half to one or something like that. This season in 2024, it's almost up to 3-1. So in the last 20 years, like a 2x increase. And I think this is reflective of A, teams and offenses just getting much smarter, understanding the importance of every possession in the game, and just being more economical and deliberate with who has the ball, where things go, stuff like that. Less isolation and like heavily stress-tested possessions. But it's also the pace and space revolution. We're living in a passing revolution. We did our top 10 passers podcast recently, and it's like the number of players in the league that can make pretty good passes on a night-to-night basis because of the space, because of the lanes to pass into and the lanes to cut into are more than ever, in my assessment. It's a, in many ways, a golden era of great passing. Not to take anything away from the cramped phone booth interior, stuff from the old days, the 80s, and things. I love it. I love that stuff as well. And it takes massive creativity back then to throw some of the super tight window passes that those players threw. But this is a big shift, and you see it explicitly when you look at something like the ratio of good to bad passes or bad pass turnovers. It's really incredible. So anyway, back to the story. Chris Paul, the area that he is better in clearly is this good to bad pass ratio area. As I said, the league shifted. So maybe relative to the league, they're not super far apart. But historically, Chris Paul is really one of the best ever. He has about a 6-1 good to bad pass ratio using this stat that I personally use. Again, these are estimates, quote unquote, bad pass or quote unquote, good pass. Every time you have a bad pass and it's tracked in the play-by-play, there's no quote unquote there other than the fact that it might be a great pass and, you know, the defender might just make a better play or something like that. So Chris Paul, like 6-1. Steve Nash, he's like 4.5, 5-1. He's not actually that far behind. So I think this is reflective of what you see on film with him being more aggressive in passing situations. But the massive, massive takeaway for me is that you don't have to figure out how to square some circle around, like, is Chris Paul really a very low turnover player and Steve Nash is a very high turnover player? And is there something in that style that actually makes Chris Paul's offense significantly more impactful or just generally more impactful? Is there something that Steve Nash is giving up? Because the reality is when you parse it this way and you add the extra context of like how often a guy has the ball, what's going on, Steve Nash turns into a very low turnover passer. Like within his seasons and even historically, is he as low as Chris Paul? No, Chris Paul is one of the all-time low sort of turnover passers relative to how many good passes he throws. But Steve Nash is also really low historically as a ball handler in terms of his turnovers. Very, very low. Again, we can calculate that by looking at how often they're dispossessed. Looking at it as a total function of their offensive load. And when we do that, Nash looks phenomenal. He looks incredibly low turnover as a ball handler. And I think as an aside, if you've seen the Steve Nash Greatest Peaks video that we put out last summer, I mean, I think that's a statistical data point that when you look at how aggressive he is with his dribbling in front of people, dribbling around people, gnashing through the paint, and then you look at the turnovers, the ball handling specific turnovers, and you go, wow, this guy's still incredibly efficient at not turning it over. He's like super low turnover as a ball handler historically. You put those two things together, I think it's a good argument that he's the best or one of the best ball handlers ever. And you can do a similar thing. You can look at Steph Curry. Steph Curry's always been pretty good in this stat. And then lo and behold, in 2023, where we did an entire thing last year in the playoffs on how good he is at protecting the ball in traffic and keeping the dribble alive in on-ball situations and commanding space, we did an entire video on that. I come back, I run these numbers shortly after, and what do you know? Steph Curry 2023, one of the all-time low seasons in that category, and a significant improvement for him from the preceding seasons, 2022, 2021, things like that. So this is where I think turnovers and turnover data can kind of help us at an individual level understand what's going on. If we look at rookies, rookies will often struggle in turnover data. I think I cited this recently, maybe in the Paolo Banchero, Cade Cunningham, that entire young player development thing. You'll often see young players be the leaders, Scoot Henderson, guys like that, in these ball handling turnovers. And then if they're really good, they have their chops and they develop in the next couple years, you'll see specific growth in that area. Similarly, as passers, there's kind of two sides to the coin. There's, can you expand your vision? Can you make passes you haven't made before? Can you make more layup passes as a percentage of your overall assists? Or are you conservatively making basic passes and kicking it to the perimeter? These are all things that we capture. If you're a member, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball, you know our passer rating stat bakes in all this information. But the flip side to the coin is explicitly looking at the risk reward, the good to bad passes. And again, you'll see a lot of rookies clean that up. They'll go from, like, you know, 1.5 to 1 ratio, 2 to 1 ratio of good to bad passes to 4 to 1 ratio if they're a good point guard or something like that. Or rookies that struggle passing, you might see them go from like a 0.5 to 1 ratio to a 1.5 to 1 ratio. This is, to me, how I'm using all this information and the important kind of interesting stories that turnovers are telling. So, speaking of that, full circle maybe, I said it would come back to Tyrese Haliburton. Tyrese Haliburton, when we were studying his jump passes, this is a guy that likes to dribble with a basketball and then jump in the air for some reason, like a kangaroo, jump, jump, jump. It started to stand out to me that he was jumping as a reactionary measure to protect the ball. And this is where I really started looking into the kind of ball handling specific types of turnovers, the all the ways you could slice passing specific turnovers. And the instinct is to say, Haliburton has all these assists and he has all these low turnovers. How does he do it? How does he make so many great passes and not make mistakes? But it turns out the low turnovers that you're seeing are not just from being smart with passes, which he is. He's obviously a great passer. And he's not a high turnover passer, but he's not getting these crazy results with the low turnovers because of the passing. It's because he doesn't get dispossessed when he dribbles the ball. In fact, if you look at players with an offensive load over 35, for those not familiar, league average might be like 27. So we're talking about guys that at least do something with the ball, but stars will be 40, 45, heliocentric, heavy lifters will be over 50, the all-time guys will be over 60. So we're talking about a lot of players that have an offensive load over 35. And if you look at all of them since 2001, this entire century basically, and look at those who have played 1,000 minutes, the lowest turnover percentage from ball handling is 2024 right now, Tyrese Haliburton. It's one of those things you just like can't make up when you're looking at it on film and you're looking, you take notes to yourself and then you start looking into this stuff statistically and you're like, oh, the thing that is drawing my attention is actually the number one. He is the most effective at not being dispossessed in the entire history, the 24-year history that we have this data. That's pretty cool. And to me, the reason I was interested in it is because it's less about the pass. He's great enough to make the pass when he's in the air, to make the right decision, right? But it's more about him realizing I'm protecting the ball as defenders approach me. And the picking it up and jumping either in traffic or in a little bit of space is a way for me to use the third dimension of verticality versus just left and right, forward and back, to protect the ball as well. It's just been phenomenal. By the way, another guy who's incredible at this, looking at some work that we've done, Tyrese Maxey. Tyrese Maxey last year was also in the top five. Players like Kyrie Irving, Allen Iverson, great ball handlers, but I think they were dispossessed a little bit more than people remember, at least relative to the flash. And we see the same thing with passers, like Pistol Pete Maravich has some of the greatest passes ever, the flashiest passes ever. LaMelo Ball, my guy, he just makes incredible passes, but he's still very loose with some of his passing decisions. And so if you only look at the highlights, it might surprise you. Iverson, Kyrie, you know, maybe they're getting stripped as they come into traffic, and maybe they've technically picked up the dribble on some of these plays, but they're very good in this category, in this stat, but there are players that are better. Steve Nash, for instance, is one of them. Chris Paul can be better. Steph Curry, in a lot of situations, looks better among the sort of like high volume, high load point guard initiator type players. Luka Doncic is another guy, by the way, for a big guard that has jumped out as being really economical with the number of times he's dispossessed. And I think that's another thing we kind of underrate about what a player like that is able to do. He can get to different spots on the court, post, back down, traffic, start around the elbow, whatever, and then carve his way into these areas without losing the ball. My hunch is Magic Johnson, if we had the data, would be phenomenal in this stat. And again, it's the kind of thing that unlocks the playmaking. It unlocks the mismatches. It unlocks high percentage offense at the basket when you're a big guard like this. We finished the Magic Johnson Greatest Peak Scout, and I remember asking Mike if he remembers a single clip where Magic was dispossessed of the dribble. And he couldn't think of one. There obviously are plenty, but it's one of those things where you start watching a lot of games and you realize, like, man, this guy doesn't really go in. He doesn't really go into the teeth and get ripped, or when he's playing out in space in transition, he doesn't lose his dribble. And how much does that unlock stuff? I don't know. I think a decent amount. Maybe we'll try to answer it. Maybe the whole concept of folding turnovers back in into scoring is to try to answer it. But a few more things on this, like you can also see players that struggle. So Dwight Howard struggles terribly in overall turnovers, but you can also see it just like the amount of times he's getting stripped or committing offensive fouls. And those are in possessions where he's almost always looking to score in the post. So what happens if we fold that in to the scoring number? I don't know. Let's do it. Let's do it, and then we can get out of here, call it a day. I've been talking for 41 minutes. This is ridiculous. We have to stop. By the way, you can look at someone like Jaylen Brown. Jaylen Brown struggles with the left hand, struggles with pressure in the playoffs, and then you go look at the sort of ball handling percentage numbers that we talked about, and he's not in a good position for guards. So it's reflective. I think oftentimes of what you see on film, it's a way to measure and put a more specific number and make certain comparisons contextually with what we see on film.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Okay, so what happens if we fold this all in to something like your scoring attempts? What if we say, forget the passing turnovers, because we know they're labeled as passing turnovers. And yes, every once in a while, it's related to a score, like we talked about with Kobe Bryant. But what if we just called these things scoring turnovers? And then we fold it all together. And the big idea is we end up with an overall scoring percentage. Not true shooting percentage. An overall scoring percentage that is your free throws, your three-pointers, your two-point shots, and your quote-unquote scoring turnovers. And we know they're quote-unquote scoring turnovers from the box score. And of course, there's going to be a small number in the backcourt or things like that that aren't related to scoring. But in theory, most players suffer those turnovers across the board, so we'll just call it a wash. Big men need all the help they can get in turnovers. By the way, I should mention, in turnovers, big men like Nikola Jokic and some of these great, talented big men, it's the same thing we just talked about with Steve Nash and Magic Johnson and those players. They will look more like the guards. If you stack up the big men, they will look like complete outliers because their profile in a stat like ball handling turnover percentage will fit more in with the guards, which again is just, it's incredible. It's incredible, but it's also something that's reflective of what we're seeing with our eyes and what intuitively we may not explicitly realize makes them so special. So, overall scoring percentage. This is similar to something Dean Oliver developed years ago, which is, I think, still on Basketball Reference, called offensive rating. Don't get it confused with points per 100 possessions. This type of offensive rating has been out of style. It's been out of vogue for years. I think he developed it back in the 90s in the Clinton administration. That's how old it is. And he was basically trying to use the box score to estimate your overall scoring efficiency. That's what he was doing. Here we can use the actual play-by-play, and you end up with something that's akin to if you went to Synergy and you said, show me all this player's scoring possessions in isolation, in post-up, in transition, off-ball, et cetera, pick and roll, right? If you did all that and you were looking for a single number that summarized volume and efficiency, points per possession, or true shooting percentage is really points per possession. It's just expressed as if all shots were two-point shots. That's all it is. That's kind of what overall scoring percentage is ballparking. That's, in theory, kind of what it's trying to do by folding in these turnovers. And I alluded to it earlier with Zion Williamson. There's an additional component we can easily add in that I've been using for 3 years since I did that Zion video, which is grabbing your own rebound. The Z-bound, named after Zach Randolph. Because apparently, Zach used to back people under the basket, park them there, turn and shoot and get his own miss. Moses Malone, obviously, is the dude who should be credited with this, right? I think we all agree on that. Moses Malone, back in the day, used to do this quite a bit. He would get you deep on the baseline, seal you with his backside, with his gluteals, and just start throwing it off the window to himself to get his own rebounds. Anyway, the point here is if we throw it to you in the post and that possession yields a score, we don't actually care that you missed two shots. If we're interested in how well you shoot the basketball, we care. If you were 1 for 3 with 2 offensive rebounds, then we really care that you're not that accurate shooting around the basket. We want to count those shots. But if we're looking for the effectiveness of your actions, and I noticed this with Tim Duncan years ago, hand tracking his plays. Shaquille O'Neal has the exact same thing. Jokic is the modern example, even more so than Zion Williamson. If the way people defend you, they're out of position as you shoot at the basket, and then you're in position and you're really big and you just tip it back in easily, or you grab the rebound and score yourself easily for a layup, we don't really care that you missed the first shot. Because the way we're sizing up the shooting data, if you just look at true shooting percentage, makes it seem like, well, player one was 6 for 10, so they got 12 points, and player two was 5 for 10, so they got 10 points. But it might be the case that player two was really 5 for 10 on 8 possessions. So they got 10 points on 8 possessions. So they have 2 more possessions to match your 12 points. And in many cases, you actually become more efficient than the guy who was 6 for 10 and scored 12 points. Man, you know, I said I wasn't going to read a bunch of numbers. And I just made up a... Why would you make up a... why would you make up a hypothetical with so many numbers, Ben? What do you think? This is Cody. Come on, you got to get back in here and help me. I'm rusty. Anyway, the big takeaway here is you can fold this in. You can fold in the scoring turnovers. You can fold in the offensive rebounds that you just sort of erase as a miss. That's what it's doing. The scoring turnover, like we saw with Kobe Bryant earlier, that would be counted as a miss as well. And remember, that's actually more detrimental in most cases to commit a turnover than to shoot. So we're not even counting it as much as we potentially could, which is why I don't worry about those backcourt turnovers and things like that. And the big takeaway is it will move your scoring efficiency to about plus or minus 2 points for 90% of the league. And then there's another 10% of the league that it'll move it 3 points or 4 points. Dwight Howard, I think, it changes it by like 5 points because Dwight Howard is a turnover machine. That's the takeaway there. In the regular season and the playoffs, Dwight Howard was a turnover machine. So you could have two dudes with the exact same true shooting percentage, and you're trying to size up, like in your head, kind of get a feel for how good they are as scorers or where they stack up in the league based on their scoring primacy and stuff like that. And you could go, got 25 points, 60% true shooting. Player one. Player two, 25 points, 60% true shooting. They sound the same. But if you actually fold these in, the overall scoring percentage for one guy might be 62% and for another guy might be 58%. And now you have a fairly material 4 percentage point difference. And you never want to disconnect that from a player's team or his context or anything like that. But now, at least in your head, ballparking the efficiency of their possessions, you have a better idea. So like when they throw it into Jokic and he does that like big tipper thing where he misses it and puts it back up, the fact that he's just erasing those misses is part of the reason the Nuggets put up 125, 128 offensive ratings, like historically great offensive ratings with him on the court, because they scored on that possession. We don't actually care about the miss the first time. And the turnovers are part of that as well, right? If you're a low turnover player, I mentioned Kobe Bryant with that 50-point game. The inverse of that is, let's say, 2003. Yes, it was 2003. I watched last summer, I think, 2003, game 4 against the Timberwolves. Okay? And in that game, he has 32 points. He's 7 of 25 from the field. So that's 28% from the floor. So he shoots terribly, but he gets a ton of free throws. So he gets the true shooting percentage up to 49%. But he only has one turnover in the whole game. So his efficiency, his overall scoring efficiency, the successful possessions the Lakers can have go up quite a bit relative to what you'd expect based on the shooting numbers. And that's what we're doing here. We're tying it all together. And when we tie it all together, can't believe this has been 51 minutes of me talking. When we tie it all together, it turns out that 2023, Nikola Jokic is the second most efficient overall scorer of this century that we have on record. The first is 2008 Amari Stoudemire, who was plus 12%, 12% ahead of the league. The thing is, Amari Stoudemire in 2008 and in the surrounding seasons was 7% lower with Steve Nash on the bench. So if he's plus 12 And then Steve Nash goes to the bench. He's really plus five. In 2005, he was plus nine. Steve Nash goes to the bench. He's plus two. So a lot of that is, to me, reflective of the greatness of Steve Nash. We're looking at an overall scoring percentage number. We're looking at the specific connections he has to teammates. Amari's a great player, great finisher, great scorer. But man, if one player can have that level of impact on a guy who's like, hey, he's a good scorer, too, this is literally the most efficient overall scoring season that we have on record. Overall scoring percentage season. That's pretty special. Jokic is second from last year. 2024 Jokic currently is plus 10%, which would be eighth on record in the 21st century. The third best season is Steph Curry's 2016 legendary season, where he leads the league in scoring rate and true shooting percentage. That's absolutely crazy. I actually haven't checked to see if he leads it in scoring rate and overall scoring percentage. I wonder if that's ever been done. This is the kind of thing you should do before a podcast. This is the kind of thing that when you've got a Cody, I can just look it up really quickly and double check my work. Well, he's talking. I can't do that here. Steph Curry 2018 is there as well. So you're going to have similar numbers to the all-time great scoring seasons, if you're familiar with those. We've done episode 1, episode 50. We've done a bunch of stuff there. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you'll be familiar with our models that try to estimate the value of scoring. This takes into account a lot of this stuff. Doesn't take into account the offensive rebounding tip-ins. And so for some players, like Nikola Jokic, like maybe Shaquille O'Neal in the playoffs in the early 2000s, this actually can move you, you know, plus or minus 2 percentage points from where your eye or where you're used to thinking of them at. If we look at the all-time greats here, Kevin Durant has 7 regular seasons among the top 25, if we just look at 25-point scores, 25 points per 75 in the last 24 years. Kevin Durant has 7 of the top 25. Steph Curry has 5 of the top 25. I think he's hurt a little sometimes by turnovers in the playoffs or lack of offensive rebounding, but he's pretty similar to how we think of him as an overall scorer. But then you get guys like Jokic. He's got 3 of them. I told you 2 this year and last year are both in the top 10. Last year, number 2 all time, behind Amari, who's being spoon-fed by Steve Nash. And so sometimes there are specific instances with players where something like offensive rebounding is actually making them hyper-efficient as scorers, and we're thinking like, is Jokic the best scorer in the league? How can he be the best scorer in the league when you see what Joel Embiid does every night? Well, Joel Embiid, if he's in the mid-range or at the free throw line a lot, is not going to have the opportunity to erase as many misses. Jokic is the king right now in the league, leads the league this year and last year by far, erasing his own misses. And so if you're the best passer ever, and all of a sudden you look at your overall scoring contributions, and they're hyper-efficient historically, now you get an idea of why you're impossible to defend. Not that we didn't know that beforehand, so I guess I just wasted 55 minutes of my life. LeBron James has 3 of the top 25 efficient seasons. Amari Stoudemire, we mentioned. Dirk Nowitzki, Shaquille O'Neal. And then here's another guy, Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler, he will not only occasionally erase his own misses, but he is fairly low turnover. And so some of these low turnover players, Kawhi Leonard looks great, Jimmy Butler, Allen Iverson can look a little better than you might think because of the turnovers. Some players like this, when you start to look at the quote-unquote overall picture, look better than what just their scoring numbers indicate. I hope that's interesting. I hope that's fun. Turnovers are a thing. They're a thing. They're a big part of basketball, but individually it's hard to make sense of them. I've personally been able to get a lot of information around like focusing on just the ball handling or the passing components. We'll try to get this stuff up for Patreon subscribers. If you want to support us directly, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. That's the best way to do it. We have proprietary stats boards historically and that update throughout the season. With some of these stats, we'll, as I said, we'll try to add more as we go forward. And that's it. Let me know how I did. This may be the last solo podcast that we ever run on Thinking Basketball. But it really depends. If you like it, if you thought it was interesting, let me know. Otherwise, thanks for listening all the way through. And of course, I hope you're having a great day.